Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show today. From the Mississippi Free Press, the co-founder, executive director, and editor, Donna Ladd, is here. This is a really fantastic conversation, I think. She's a fascinating person. And the Mississippi Free Press is doing really amazing, remarkable work, taking local journalism and making it relevant, I think, to stuff happening on the national level. This is, I didn't know anything about the Free Press until I sort of discovered them on Twitter, because some of these articles were being shared widely because the reporting is so good. And even though they focus on stuff happening in Mississippi, what they focus on applies elsewhere in the country because that's just the nature of the coverage. The mission of the Free Press is to really, you know, key in on these local places and do what Donna calls systemic reporting, which looks at systems and does deep dives into how things got to be the way they are, and then solutions-based journalism, which is how we can fix those things. So it's really a great organization. It's a great publication. They have really good reporters. I recommend following them on Twitter, bookmark the page, and if you can, donate to the project. It's just, you know, it's really good stuff. Donna herself is a fascinating person. She was born in rural Mississippi, in the same county as the Mississippi burning murders that happened right when she was a small child. So she's always been very aware of racism and very interested in it and wanting to be an activist, an anti-racism activist from a very young age. And she left Mississippi as soon as she could, went around the country doing jobs here and there, wound up being a journalist. Went to Columbia Journalism School, you know, later in life to get her master's in journalism, and has done a bunch of remarkable things. And it's just, you know, she has a lot of things to say about race, obviously, about misogyny in journalism and in the country and stuff like that, about media in general and how the media failed, and about Mississippi and what we can learn from Mississippi, what people like me in New York can learn about, you know, can learn from Mississippi, which I think we all can. It's an inherently fascinating place, I think. And the history is so essential to what is America, for better and for worse, you know, because a lot of things happened there that are not so good. And a lot of things happened there and people came from there who were these wonderful, talented, amazing people. So I think Mississippi is super interesting, fascinating, worthy of taking a look at. And, you know, Donna was terrific. So I'm going to stop talking now. I want to get right to the interview. We'll be right back with Donna Ladd.
Hello, me Rob Munster. Me like free speech. Me own Munster web host company called Epic. Epic spelled with K. Why with K? Because K is for Klansmen. We host them every day. K is for Klansmen. We hope them every day. K is for Klansmen. We host them every day. Oh, Epic like to host a KKK. You know how Monster Web Company track where you go? Cookies. This Rob Monster. Now back to show. Goodbye.
Donna Ladd, welcome to the Prevail podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you are the founding editor and the executive director of the Mississippi Free Press, which is something that I found basically on Twitter. you know, I'm on Twitter. I don't know how they do their algorithms or this or that, but for some reason, I was drawn to the reporting that you guys have been doing, especially lately in the time of COVID and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just really good. Like it was good enough to attract my attention from up here in New York to be like, oh my God, these guys are doing really good work. And also what's going on down there. So first of all, congratulations on that. It's just,
Thank you. From
where I sit, it's a pretty successful, venture, at least in terms of penetrating the bubble of all the stuff that's out there, in the world. I'm gesticulating with my arms and you can see me, but nobody listening can see me. But I'm doing to do it anyway. Before we start though, I want to ask, okay, so the Hurricane Ida came through. How are you? How is everybody in your neck of the woods? Are you okay? Obviously you have power, so that's good.
Yeah. Actually, I'm in the capital city, you know, in Jackson, which is central Mississippi. And we didn't know what to expect because, you know, we were also here for Katrina and didn't have power for 2 weeks and all sorts of things around that. In Jackson, you know, a couple hours from the coast or almost 3 hours, I think. And but this one didn't hit us. It didn't hit us too hard. Here in the capital city. I mean, it felt, for my house, it just felt like another storm. And we were very fortunate. We were ready, you know, bathtub full of water and all that. But so for us, we're fine. That doesn't mean that everybody on the coast is fine, obviously. And but it's also not as bad for people as Katrina and past hurricanes. So it's kind of that mixed bag.
Okay, that's good to hear. Because sometimes it's hard to tell if you're not in it. And especially sometimes if it's not super catastrophic, the media just forgets about it. And all these people are suffering and nobody finds out. And it's almost worse in a sense. So I was just curious to, I just wanted to start with that.
Well, and I should say there are people who have devastating impacts from flooding, you know, along the coast and in other areas. So I'm not taking away from that at all.
No, of course. I want to talk to you today about, I want to talk about you because you've had a pretty remarkable career and a pretty remarkable, as I see it, pretty remarkable life, pretty really impactful and, just cool. What's the word? Exemplary career in life. And it's really nice to see that. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about Jackson Free Press, Mississippi Free Press, and how those things came to be and your career there. I want to talk about institutionalized racism and the reporting that goes into the systemic, as you call it, systemic reporting on those issues, and which is something I know you're a big proponent of. And I know there's a big project, I guess, that you guys are rolling out and how you're going to attack that. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about just the mainstream media in general and how you see it has changed and failed and not failed. And, you know, in the last 20 years, but also in the last 5 years, maybe.
Right.
And then also I want to talk about Mississippi because I was telling you this before we hit record. I just find Mississippi inherently fascinating. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's because we used to say the word a lot. We played like football on the playground, you know, one Mississippi two, but I think it's cool. There's something inherently cool about it. And it's this diverse mix of lots of different stuff going on. And you have these super talented people that come out of Mississippi. And yet you also have things like, you know, very low rankings in education and stuff like that. So it almost doesn't make sense to me. So I want to try to pick your brain and maybe maybe you can help me make sense of it a little bit.
Well, I actually appreciate you calling it cool. That's something I don't often hear about Mississippi, but yeah, there's, it's a complicated place.
Complicated. That's a good, that's a good word for it. So start off a little bit, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got to be where you are. Cause you have a pretty interesting backstory.
Well, I always like to say it's kind of an essay question, I think the most important thing, I think, where I always start is the fact that I'm from Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is Neshoba County. And that is where Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner were killed when I was three, the three civil rights workers, Mississippi Burning, as they call it.
Right.
And they were people I knew, and at least in one case related to, were part of that lynch mob. But what I would say is the most relevant about that is that I didn't know about it until I was 14.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of that transition generation and everybody shut down about it, you know? And nobody would talk about it after all of the media coverage and all, and the case, the trial, the federal trial and all that. But in the interim, the bizarre part is that, first of all, I come from what I can say were two illiterate parents, although my father could write a little bit and went to the third grade. But my mother never went to school a day in her life until she was 60, but that's the other end of the story. And I came along later in life with two older brothers, but I grew up like an only child. So I was like really into, I read a lot, and she really pushed encyclopedias on me and the freedom. And, when I was old enough to start writing, she kept her illiteracy secret. So I would do all of her business, as she called it, and those kind of things. But the other thing that was true is that I was, people often ask me why and how, but I was kind of obsessed about racism, even as an elementary school kid. I was writing about these things in my diary. I tend to think it was because my mother was really smart and really open-minded within her ability to, she used the N-word when I was little. So that was what everybody said, right? But it was kind of like at one point I said, that's not a good word. Don't do that anymore. And she said, I'm sorry, and stopped doing it. Because she understood that, right?
Yeah.
At that point. So, I just kind of came up obsessed with in public schools there, obsessed with racism, also sexism. I was very outspoken in school about sexism and women's lib, as we called it then in the 70s. I didn't really know what being a journalist, certainly not the kind of journalism I am, was, because we didn't have any good journalism in the state when I was growing up here. And in fact, very bad journalism, which you're probably aware of, very racist journalism earlier on. And so I was kind of had this activist spirit, and so I wanted to change things. But at the same time, I was so, especially after I found out about Cheney, Goodman, Schwerner, I was so angry at Mississippi and how it just kept trying to push me out. That's the way I felt about it. And it, trust me, it's tried to since I've been back too, but they're out of luck this time. So I had this push pull to get out or to stay and change things, but I honestly couldn't stay. And I ended up going to Mississippi State here because I couldn't afford to go elsewhere and got a scholarship. Thought I was going to become a civil rights attorney, so study political science and all that. A John Stennis scholarship, which is interesting. And now I know the more complicated history of Senator Stennis than I did then. But but the day after I graduated from Mississippi State, I left and I was going to go to law school. And I did go to law school, I think, for a semester at George Washington, hated it. Ended up dropping out and becoming a club DJ, but that's no story. It's true. True story. The club DJ stuff is what funded me becoming a journalist. So it was all okay. Good. But so then I got on a, just started, and I'll kind of stop the story here and let you take me where you want me to go. But I kind of got involved with local journalism. You know, I started getting involved in local journalism in other places. And I was a self-taught journalist. I never studied journalism until I went to Columbia, bizarrely enough. My mama would have been proud. When I was 40, in a mid-career master's, and which is funny to me, but and then ended up coming back to Mississippi. But I just skipped a bunch of stuff. But it was, that's the kind of path. It was, what I always tell people is that it was backward. You know, I didn't set out. I didn't know what kind of journalism. You know, I thought of journalism as just he said, she said crap. You know. Right. The kind of stuff I was growing up around, and that we still have too much of in some cases. But I didn't really understand the, I like to write, and that, you know, that journalism could be well written. It wasn't like we were getting the best journalism in Mississippi, or at least yeah. I wasn't, you know. So, you know, so it was just kind of self-made along the way and following my instincts, I guess.
I think it's interesting that it worked out for you that way, because My sense of journalism is almost better to have a broader base of operations and understanding of things and then do it, mm-hmm. rather than if you're just doing that, you don't have something else to draw from. So I mm-hmm. see, I'm not surprised that you know, someone who, first of all, who writes as well as you do has done other things. You talked about the story with your parents. There's a beautiful piece that you wrote in The Guardian about your mother, which is, I read it before this interview this morning, and you know, it made me teary, as I said. I encourage everybody to go check that out. But to come from that background, you're also in a position where you do have to kind of figure it all out on your own. It's not like you come from a family of journalists where they say, okay, now you go to Columbia J School, and from there you go work at AP or whatever. You know, it's a non-traditional thing. I used to be a recruiter at Associated Press, just sort of randomly. So, you know, the way that we looked for certain people, but it was always better in my mind to get people from different backgrounds and that had different life experiences that they could, you know, pull into the thing. So wait, when you were the club DJ, were you still in Washington or were you somewhere else? This is important.
I was in Washington. I started it right downtown there. It was for, you know, what they at least used to call the pubic triangle, but down at where Deja Vu and those, I wasn't a Deja Vu. I was at a place around the corner. And then there was a place called, actually Deja Vu was a big club then. And I ended up there. It was when we were all playing the trendiest thing where it was like big chill music because of that era, you know, for young people, you know, at meat markets, they're like dancing to Motown. And so I got to know a lot of music, and it was just natural for me because, you know, I hadn't heard a lot of Black music growing up, quote unquote, Black music. And it was during that time that I just kind of embraced all sorts of music. And I like to dance. So I was just kind of, I was kind of a natural at it. I love doing it. And it's what, one thing I always say about DJing is that it, that's when I learned not to be shy on a microphone, because I had to learn that, because a lot of it was about talking. And as a woman club DJ, then I was actually really unusual. So people like that, and people would call me the dancing DJ because I'd be dancing in the DJ booth and stuff. But it really was, I talk about that as a, especially to young people, because it gets their attention, A. But second, it's part of my career. It was to figure out, for two reasons. One, to get past that shyness, you know, of just kind of talking on a microphone, then get on my feet, right? The second was that most of the club owners I worked for were intensely racist. And this was during the early 80s. And I like to say Madonna and I became successful in the music world at the same time. But hip hop was crossing over, right, into mainstream dance music. And so, of course, you get this mix of people who and white people wanting, you know, more hip hop music mixed in. And I cannot tell you, because I worked in a number of different clubs after a while, and I did it over 10 years and five states, but that's another subject. But the club owners in all of those states, none of which were Deep South, would come up to me and tell me to stop playing that in music. Every wow. state. And Massachusetts had happened, you know, so what one of the lessons it taught me, along with some other things that happened, because when I left Mississippi, I was so angry at Mississippi, and I believed it was the most racist place on the planet and blah, 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 you know, and the club work, along with some other experiences just with idiots, taught me that this is a real, real universal problem. It's just people don't face it enough and don't understand it. And they want to scapegoat a place like Mississippi, which deserves all sorts of I don't know, it deserves deep understanding of the racism and the racist roots and the things that happened here. But those were things that were benefiting the country. And I even have a series coming out soon that's going to explain more in depth about how a lot of our racism was kind of funded from elsewhere. And our efforts. And so it's complicated. But anyway, that's my DJ answer, is that it really taught me a lot at a time where I was having a good time drinking and dancing and getting other people to dance at the same time.
No, it sounds like you had a lot of fun. And again, it informs everything going forward. It made me think when you mentioned, obviously, the pervasive racism everywhere, but the tendency of people elsewhere to be like, well, you know, Mississippi is the real racist place and that kind of thing. Where I don't know what the psychological term is. I guess maybe it is scapegoating, where you just say, you know, let's put it all on that. I don't know if you saw, there's a documentary on HBO called Exterminate All the Brutes that ran.
You know, I haven't seen it. I know about it.
It's don't watch it if you're in a depressed mood, I would say, but it's very, very interesting and well done. And one of
the race science,
it's about that, but it's there's a lot of Nazi stuff in there. And he's saying is that what we the story we like to tell ourselves in Europe, and especially in the United States, is that the Nazis were, you know, they did this terrible thing. They tried to kill all the people and take their land. We went there and fought them and defeated them. And now we're done. You know, we wipe our hands and it's clean, without looking at the fact that, you know, 200 years or 150 years before that, white Americans here did the same thing with the, you know, with the native population. So the fact that we look at, well, Nazis are bad, we know that, is similar in my mind to, you know, racists in the North saying, well, you know, Mississippi are the real racists, without it, you know, without taking ownership of it themselves. That's what I'm
right. And it's even closer than that. And I won't go too deep into this because a lot of it's going to be in my series, but the connections between what was going on with the efforts to blow up racism in the South and the North and the roots, and also early on the roots between what was going on with Northern racism and the Nazis. I mean, all of that is, you know, all of that is part of our history. And then on slavery, you know, that one kind of makes me really crazy because, you know, even by the time there's so much history there, I could go on, but you know, Wall Street was benefiting from slavery long after the North had officially abolished slavery. And so there's so much there. And a lot of the money from a lot of the people who were large slave owners in the Deep South, you know, were from other places. And I don't say that, I hate it. I want to put that in context. And I think you know this because you follow us and read us. That is in no way taken away from what was happening right here in the South. I mean, we're probably the loudest and most direct critics, or, you know, amateur historians about the truth about Mississippi. We have a Mississippi Race Violence Project going on where we're going county to county to explain that this blanket of white terrorism was over the whole state, and it went way beyond the Klan. And so I want your listeners to understand, I'm not another one of those Southerners who said, oh yeah, but there's racism everywhere. My thing is that you own your own stuff and you understand it. And then you understand the connections outside. And then you call out all those people around the country who kind of think that, you know, they want to put all the country's racist history in Mississippi or the Deep South and then not look at their own front yards or what their own stuff is named for, you know, right. Even with naming and statues. I'm all about, and you know, moving these horrific Confederate statues and, you know, all of these things. But they're just, I mean, Massachusetts alone, the things that institutions are named for, and including in Harvard and some of their own presidents did and such, is just, people need to understand that this is a national problem and we need a national reckoning. And what you said at the beginning of this conversation about Mississippi and paying attention to what's going on in Mississippi, and especially the kinds of stuff that, you know, the look at you in the eye reporting, as one of our donors called us, what we're willing to put out there about the truth can help other people, you know, connect the dots in their own states. And we encourage them to do that. And you've probably seen, we call out people who show up and just, oh, well, that's the reason, boycott everything in Mississippi. It all sucks. It's like, no, there are a lot of good people in Mississippi. Mississippi sure. is the most beaten down state. And why is, you know, in part because we have the highest proportion of African Americans. So we're a huge threat politically, which people don't want to look at it that way. But yeah, so it's complicated, but nobody gets off the hook. No state gets off the hook in any of this. No city gets off the hook. Even when you come to race violence and race massacres, you know, people, they're in denial, you know? So we don't allow that denialism.
I think, you know, part of it is denial and part of it is ignorance, whether willful mm-hmm. or not. And one of the problems in the country, I've talked about this a lot, is that there is no, you mentioned reckoning. There is no reckoning. There's no mm-mm. atonement. There's no attempt ever to go back and review what we did and, you know, try to redress the situation and learn from it and it somehow make atonement for the horrible things that we've done, you know, in a society. I think you can draw, even just politically, you can draw a through line from Reconstruction, where it was, you know, once Lincoln was killed, you know, Johnson said, okay, let's just hurry this along. Everything's fine now. Move it, you know, and then, you know, Southern states used the 13th Amendment and created these laws and effectively just, you know, the racism, it wasn't slavery anymore, but it was still racism. And then stuff just got baked into the, you know, to the laws everywhere. I mean, in New York City, you could not buy an apartment if you were Black unless it was in Harlem or in Bed-Stuy until fairly yeah. recently, I think in my lifetime, you know.
Right.
These are things that most people don't know anything about because there has not been, as you said, this national, federal level overreaching attempt for all of us to come together and say, holy shit, this thing happened. It was terrible. You know, nobody's going to, it's not a blame game. And I think a lot of the people that are scared of this are afraid that people are going to blame them for being white or whatever, but it's not about that. It's about knowledge. It's about, let's figure out what happened. Let's make sure that, you know, that we can atone for it if it's at all possible. And certainly the more knowledge we have about it, the less likely that it is to happen again. The other thing I wanted to say, just, you mentioned this earlier, is sexism and misogyny and stuff like that. And that's something that, you know, we still haven't had the big, you know, global reach about that. I've said this before on the podcast too. We've had the Black Lives Matter protests, which were fantastic. We haven't had the Women's Lives Matter protests. That's something that people don't think about, I think. And I'd like to see something like that happen too, where we go back and say, you know, women could only vote in this country for 100 years. That's like nothing. You know, there's a lot of institutionalized sexism, just like there's institutionalized racism, and it all contributes to how society is now. So the work that you guys are doing at the Free Press, I think, is really, really vital to, you know, to hipping people to what happened and the history of the things. And, you know, and I believe, maybe naively, that most people are inherently good people and some of them just don't know any better. And if they're taught these things, you know, society will improve. So anything that helps that, I'm all for.
Well, wow, so much there. One thing I want to not get past there, which you came back to, is what is true is that people in Mississippi were, especially once you get beyond the major planters and then ultimately Confederate officers and all of those people who control all this and frankly still do in their own way, from the powerful. I mean, we were America. I mean, it's these, you know, my people, some of whom own slaves, not huge slave owners, but this surprised me, you know, because right. I was one of those Mississippians who we were too poor to own slaves. Yeah, later. But, you know, people followed that path. And, you know, and so, and it was the path of riches and, you know, it was the American dream at that point for my family to go south and try to work their way up to owning people. And there were a lot of people, so they had free labor. And so there was a lot, there were a lot of people who did that. So my point is, this was a human thing. And what has ended up happening in the South, and other places, is that people don't know the history. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I talk to who don't know that there were these horrific race massacres in places like Omaha, or, you know, that one, you know, if you've read Cast, there's a lot of detail in there. So I guess what I'm saying is that people, you're right, that people are ignorant about our history because it's not taught. And I do think, or it's not, the powerful don't want us to teach it.
Right.
And that's the same with misogyny, because it changes the dynamic. I mean, it's what we're seeing with this, all the freak out over 1619 project. It's what we're, you know, and then this 1776, we got to be proud of everything. No, we don't, actually. Yeah. What we can be proud of is that if we continue building a truly free for all democracy, that, you know, that's what we can be proud of. And as you say, that is about women too. I mean, look, the suffrage movement, it was great, but it was racist. I mean, you know, they pushed Ida B. Wells. They didn't even want her at the front of the parade in New York. And then she put herself up there anyway, which I love. That's the kind of spirit that I appreciate. And she pushed herself to the front. But, you know, that was true everywhere. I mean, here in Mississippi, you know, there were some former Confederate generals, including he was a lieutenant general, but the man that, you know, my alma mater, Mississippi State, honors, who he was for women's suffrage. And you talk about Reconstruction, because they wanted more white people voting. And so there were people who wanted it for that reason. And so there were, it's all complicated, right? And then those systems, those misogyny and sexism systems, you know, they've permeated media forever.
Sure.
I mean, throughout my career, so many stories. And we have not fully faced it. We are going through an attempt at reckoning now, you know, and putting, you know, having more women in leadership roles. But one of the dirty little secrets that most women don't know until they take a leadership role is there's a whole new level of sexism waiting there. And this isn't from the right. This is from across the board.
Yeah.
And it's from women. And so you kind of get into this place where women are expected to be these nurturers, no matter what you do. And, you know, there's studies that say you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You know, they don't respect you. You do, you become the nurturer, but if you don't, they hate you. And so it's these things that that keep women down, or they push them out of journalism. I mean, part of the reason that I do my own thing is the sexism that horrible sexism that I ran into in various ways and still do, in journalistic circles and from bosses or from colleagues, especially if you're willing to speak up. I mean, people just, they're going to try to punish the woman. That's just true. It doesn't matter if it's true or false, you know? So you have to have such a tough skin. And in a state like Mississippi, where there's so much misogyny still in the DNA, mm-hmm. and worked out yet. You know, it's just, you're right on that. I mean, we've got to face it. And part of the reason that we are a women founded and run, our board of directors has 9 people, 8 of them are women, and we are unapologetic about that. And we do things differently. Now, we're not a women's publication. We're not like the 19th, you know, which is great. We started at the same time as pandemic started. They're national. We're technically local, although we have a lot of national visibility and readers.
Yeah.
But we are not, we are not for women. We are for everybody. And we believe, not criticizing that, I think that's great, but that what they're doing, we believe that women run media will be very good for everybody, you know. And our Kimberly and I, you know, we work together. She's Black, I'm white. We run this in a very inclusive way. We don't have to wring our hands every 6 months because we didn't interview enough people that weren't white men, because we just don't do it that way.
Yeah.
Right. It's not our, it's not one of those things that we have to worry about. And then we have white male reporters as well as, you know, we have a Black woman reporter. We actually have a Black man reporter coming in. But my point is, that's fine. We want good male reporters. You know, Ashton Pittman.
Yeah, he's great.
He's a white male reporter. You know, he's also a married gay man in Mississippi. And but he comes from a evangelical background and went to a SEG Academy for a while. So he understands Mississippi and lives in South Mississippi, you know. So what I'm saying is that that's the kind of changes that I want to see, is really at the heart of things. It's not a, it's not window dressing, right? It's different kinds of decision making. We don't do horse race political coverage because we're not this, like, into this testosterone soaked, as I would call it, obsession with party.
Yeah.
You know, I know too much about history and what's gone on with Republicans and Democrats for 200 years, you know, ever since the, what, Democrat Republican Party. I mean, you know, it's like it changes. So we are focused on people. And I think that, and their issues. And I think that that's women, not all women, but I think women leaders can help ensure that we keep that focus on what matters to everyday lives. Part of the reason we did such great COVID reporting, especially in this fourth wave with the schools, mm-hmm. is because we bothered to really focus on what's going on with women and children, and we don't let up on that. And I think we are leading, and I think some other people have kind of followed in the state after we started doing that, but they weren't paying attention to those things as much as we were. We made it a really big deal that a little Black girl in Smith County died, you know, from COVID, because that really mattered. So
I think, you know, what you're saying is super important, because it is the way that things are covered and what is covered, what they choose to cover and what they don't choose to cover is just, you know, it's limited by the people in the room at the meeting, at the news meeting, and what they think is important. So like, I remember there was a story when I worked at AP where this was a story circulating. Kurt Cobain died, which was a big deal to anybody at that time under the age of like 25. And the Seattle news editor called the general desk and said, Kurt Cobain died. You got to run this on the A wire. And whoever was working the general desk was some old fuddy-duddy who had no idea who Kurt Cobain was. And the Seattle person had to scream and yell for a while to get him to put it on the A wire. So that's a stupid example, but it's the same thing. Like, we're all limited by our own experiences. So the more diverse experiences you can have in a room, you know, certainly a newsroom, the better, I think, because, you know, who knows what's it. You guys have done really great COVID coverage, I think. Is it that Intervectin story about the horse, you know, the horse and the cow thing? I'm sure I read that from Ashton Pittman wrote that story. That was the first time I saw it. And then it was everywhere after that. So,
well, you're absolutely right. He led on that. And then Maddow jumped on it because, and, you know, and she's been a fan of our work dating back to the Jackson Free Press. In fact, her, I don't know if I ever say this out loud, but one of her longtime producers, Laura Conaway, was my editor at the Village Voice at one point. And so we've known each other for a while. And and there's a lot of belief in women, women run journalism in these circles. But I wanted to give you back an example of what you were saying, a story, because I would also say, yes, it's about more than diverse newsrooms though, and diverse perspectives in the newsrooms. It's about, and then I'll give you my example. It's about white people studying and listening and training. You know, I had 3 years of training through, I was a W.K. Kellogg leadership fellow, and a lot of what I did, you know, I was in the minority, and I did a whole lot of listening and training in different structural, institutional, systemic racism, systemic thinking, all of those kinds of things that kind of built me to the point where I think I could do MFP. But my story, when I applied for Columbia, it was kind of a lark. But I was in Colorado at that moment, but anyway, that doesn't matter. I was talking to a professor there. I visited, and I got together with this professor that somebody had recommended to me, a white man, not going to say who it was. I don't think he's still there. I don't think. And we were having a conversation. Oh, I know what it was. I had applied already. And at the time, and I don't know if they still do this, they did a current events test.
Okay.
And it was actually, I think it was, maybe it was fill in the blank. It must have been fill in the blank, but it was, so they're trying to make sure that you know what's going on in the world. Okay, that's fine, whatever. It was 30 questions about newsmakers. One question, the answer was a woman, and it was Toni Morrison. So it kind of hit a couple bases.
Yeah.
That's fine. So when I met with this professor, we were talking about Columbia and such, and I told him that. I said, you know, here I am, a 40-year-old woman, just saying what I think, right? And almost 40. And I told him about that, and I said, how is it that in 30 questions about newsmakers, that it's mostly about white men, and there was one woman as the answer? And his answer to me was, because there weren't many women making news last year. And I kind of just sat there and looked at him, because if you can't see the logical circle, illogical circle that you got yourself caught in here, you know, the horse around the track here, then I'm not sure how I can help you. So that was that. And, you know, in my experience, I did Columbia over 2 years. And my experiences, and I got the alumni, or one of the alumni awards this year, which shocked the shit out of me. But so, you know, I feel like I can say things, but I would call it half good experience and half bad experience. Yeah. And a lot of the bad experience, I mean, I had some of the shit that people said to me because I was a white woman from the South, and I'm talking professors, white male professors who were belittling. And, you know, just assuming they're not talking about things like you are, these particular ones. And, you know, I learned the most there from Manny Marable, because I was doing a mid-career thing and found myself over in the Black Studies Institute, and, you know, and did some, I was able to do things outside the journalism school. I learned a lot about my process and making writing better, legal. You know, there was some good stuff I learned. But some of that bullshit misogyny and that I ran into particularly, or even just regional bigotry, really opened my eyes about the media, because this is where they were being taught, in this kind of arrogance about being at Columbia and all of that. I mean, I hated it. And, I had a woman advisor who suggested that I come back to Mississippi to do my master's project in Mississippi. And I'd never been a journalist here. And that, and the fact that I went to therapy to deal with some of the bullshit misogyny at Columbia, in therapy, we talked about Mississippi a lot, and that's what sent me home to Mississippi, which I'm actually very grateful. No, I'm more open about that now. I didn't used to talk about it as much, but I'm very grateful that all it ultimately I'm just Buddhist enough to say, okay, all of it was part of the plan, but, or part of the, you know, the path. But it was those parts were awful. I mean, because it was another, it was like that DJ thing.
Yeah.
Where I'm in the North, I'm thinking, all that bullshit racism and sexism is behind me. And my eyes were like eyes wide open, right? And then I'm at Columbia and learning those and seeing those things happen in front of me. And at the time, there were very few Black students there. And I was questioning some of that, you know, and it, well, I can't afford it. Well, I get it, but, you know, let's figure it out. Now I had an amazing friend there, Linnell Hancock, you know, who really helped me get through a lot of this. But so what is true is that I learned from every one of those experiences, because I do choose to learn from negative experiences. That's part of my ethos. But, you know, so that's what I would say to people. And if you went, if you're somebody who studied or became a journalist through this old school, I mean, I don't even like national versus local journalism labels anymore, because it's like, what does that even mean? You know, in the past it's meant national journalists, and so they can get away with anything they want and they can use your stories and not give you credit. I mean, that's what we local journalists think of. But, you know, what I would say to anybody working in media, that if you're in it for anything more than the money and the prestige, figure this stuff out, you know, seek out training, visit other places, study the history, because, you know, people do need to be part of the solution. And, you know, I'm self-taught in all of the history, all of the things, because that's what I care about. I want to understand why things are the way they are. We can't change the systems if we don't understand why the systems exist.
No, that's a good point.
Season 2 of Swing Left's How We Win is here.
All over the country, people like you stepped up to help hold the House, win control of the Senate, and put Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in the White House.
Now we have an incredible opportunity and responsibility to wield our people power to fight for our democracy.
Trump may be gone, but the GOP is still clearly the party of Trumpism. We must stay engaged to make sure we hold on to power and expand our majorities.
But how do we do that in the face of historic attacks on voting rights, conspiracy theories that defile the truth, and systemic racism at the roots of our institutions?
Season 1 brought you answers and tools to make a difference from guests such as Speaker Nancy Pelosi,
DeRay McKesson,
actor Billy Eichner,
Stacey Abrams, Michael Moore, Katherine Hahn, Karen Bass, and many more.
For Season 2, we're going even deeper into the issues that matter the most.
And, of course, what you can do about it.
We don't agonize, we organize.
And we've got a lot of work to do.
Subscribe right now on Apple and everywhere you get your pods for insight, action, and your reasons for hope. I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Mariah Craven.
And this is Season 2 of How We Win.
You talked about it before, like the loop that bad professor had in his brain about how it opens. Like, they do it on the, I never watch the news on TV unless it's like an election night or 9/11 or something like that. But, you know, people complain about it on Twitter all the time. I'm watching CNN and this person's on, I'm turning it off. And it's like, then turn it off and leave it off. Why are you, you know, why is Michael Moore on? Why is a guy like that? Why are you recycling these old retread people that don't have anything new to offer, that are not representative of anything other than he's a guy that people kind of vaguely, you know, understand. Even like last night, my friend was watching, last night, I say right now, it's September 15th. This won't run for a little while, but was the California recall. So my friend had CNN on and was complaining, like, what? And Bernie Sanders is on talking about the California thing. And said, why is Bernie Sanders there? What does he have to do with that? He's He's not from California. He's never lived in California. He's not even a member of the Democratic Party. So why is he on TV? Because he's just yet another familiar face that they, you know, that they think people want to see. And in a sense, they're training us to want to see rather than just putting somebody on because they're interesting or good and letting it and not worrying so much about the clicks and the ratings and, you know, and being patient and letting the good work come out, which is what happened with Rachel Maddow, by the way. Right. She kind of started out and then took that job. And then everyone was like, wow, she's really great. Let's watch her.
Well, she's about the only, and I don't watch her regularly. I mean, she, you know, cause I don't watch that much TV. But she's smart. I mean, that's the thing she's using, and her producers, as I know very well, are smart and they're paying attention to everything going on in the country. One of the things I really appreciate about Rachel is that other people may not ever notice is that she never belittles the state of Mississippi. She will talk about our leaders and, you know, and what's going on here, but she always says the great state of Mississippi, or she always, it's like, she knows that there are people in Mississippi. There are good people here working hard to overcome the systems. And what I always say about Mississippi is that Mississippi is just the most ingrained microcosm, which has a whole lot to do with being the richest from slavery, if people would actually pay attention, you know, and what happened as a result of that, and where the Mississippi River is. All of that has a whole lot to do with you know, the realities of Mississippi today. And so I really appreciate that about Rachel. You know, she's smart. Now, and it's kind of what you're talking about. It's like, you get a situation where, you know, I think it was Andy Lack when he was at NBC, hired, what's her name from Fox?
Megan. Yeah.
And then they're all surprised that she says offensive things on race. It's like, you hired her because you want that crowd. You just don't want it to go a little bit too far, you know? Yeah. But here's the thing. That was a really bad decision. It cost him a lot of money. But that's the kind of thing we ought to be able to see before we do it.
Yes.
You know, we ought, anybody who's a media leader, I don't care what level you're on, ought to be able to say, that's not worth it. You know, but that's this, and you probably see us talk about beyond partisanship, which is a phrase that I kind of started using, and then I'm always whining and railing against horse race politics. But it's that, it's the horse race of all this punditry, you know, that you've got to have these extremes yelling at each other. And if those folks can't see, especially on the national high levels that drive so much of the attention, Trump, like, I fully believe Trump is going to be president. I'm from Mississippi. And when he won the New York primary, you know, I turned to Todd and I said, he's going to be president. He just won the New York primary, Republican primary. It's like, that says a whole lot. You add it up. So it's kind of like, if people were thinking about, you know, how much we're going to use him for fun and we're going to get all these ratings.
Right.
We're not going to think about that this could actually work, because they don't know enough. They don't understand enough about the country and this level of division that they helped put in place with this kind of two-sided. I don't even like parties. I've said that I don't like parties, but I don't like you know, the red blue this or that false equivalency. And so what I think part of what I'm not sure people can always know what they like about what we do at the Mississippi Free Press. I mean, I'm not being belittling there, because I think a lot of it's built in. But one of the things we just reject, that he said she said thing. Now, what that means is that we piss off Democrats, and we have since the Jackson Free Press launched 19 years ago, because they want to think that we're progressive or liberal or whatever the label of the day is. I don't like labels. And they want to think that. And then, you know, we come out with a story about, you know, the Democratic Attorney General who's running for governor and how awful he is on the death penalty, and you know, we don't care, you know, he'll put a black mayor of Jackson in prison or in jail and on trial. And so it just doesn't matter, you know, but we have to reject that frame. And that's kind of our argument. You know, we're letting powerful people divide us into two and into two parts and tell us where the acceptable middle is. And that's not okay. And they're it's driven by white men, you know, and it's just not okay. You know, and I just, we reject it.
It's driven by white men, and it's driven by very few white men. That's the other problem, is that the you know, the media outlets, especially this TV stations, are run, owned and operated by these people. And I think with guys like Lack, and certainly with Jeff Zucker at CNN, they knew what they were doing with Trump. I mean, they knew exactly what they were doing. It wasn't about clicks. It was very, very mendacious. And, you know, and we're all paying the price for that. You know, again, not to be party this or that, because I've been arguing this for a long time. Like I wrote a book about the Russia Trump stuff in 2018. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with political parties. It's not because Trump is a Republican, because he's really not. He's mm-hmm. Trump is a Trump, you know. He just happened to, that was the party that he was able to co-opt and you know, like a you know, in a science fiction movie or something, where he assumes the, you know, he takes over the body of the party and it's wandering around like a zombie, like it's possessed. I mean, that's what happened to that political party for the most part. I mean, there's obviously some exceptions. So it's not about, at this point, it's not politics. It's not partisan. It's, are you for democracy or not? And I think that, you know, journalism in general is almost inherently pro-democratic, in small d democrat, you know,
small d,
democracy, democratic. And, and has to be, because if we're a tyranny, if we're an autocratic state, then the first thing that goes is the free press. I mean, Mussolini literally went to the presses and destroyed them by hand. The actual press.
Right. And the misogyny in that, it's like, you know, and I didn't start out. I mean, I wrote a column several years back, you know, critiquing the Clintons. I'm not a big Clintonite, you know, but the misogyny against Hillary Clinton that still continues, whatever that economist tweet was, that she was on to something back a few, you know, on to something. Maybe she just knew what she was talking about the women being important in the world. You know, that happened like in the last week or two. But, you know, the whole, you know, I wrote a piece in Dame magazine.
I love Dame.
Did you see that piece? And it was kind of focused on, take a look at it. It was focused on, you know, Ronan's book and kind of Andy Lack, you know, because Andy Lack also has a presence in Mississippi. So that's an interest for us. But this talk that he gave after the election at Ole Miss, or the University of Mississippi, as I prefer to call it, with, I think, John Meacham, to, you know, an audience of mostly white people, basically saying that they did nothing wrong in the media with Trump, and that it was all about Hillary Clinton's being unlikable across the country.
Oh, God.
Have we learned nothing? Do you see what I mean? It's like, really? You know, it's like, but nobody made a big deal out of that, other than, you know, I wrote about it for Dame and gave some of his track record on some of these things. But that's just misogyny.
Yeah,
that part like unlikable. That's just pure and simple. And so it kind of goes back to that professor at Columbia.
Yeah,
that's misogyny too. You are sexism. You don't know that. I can tell, because you're caught in the loop. But
yeah, well, wait, when did he do that? That was after 2016, right? This is fairly recent that Lack did this, or
no? He did it. It would have been, I think it was early. So Trump took the office in 2016.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So I think it was soon after he took office.
Okay, that's what. Yeah, so. Not only is he repeating a narrative, the narrative was proven like demonstrably false. Like Hillary got the second most, at that time, the second most votes of anyone ever. So
I say that in the Dame piece.
Yeah.
It's like
how is that unlikable? What are you talking about?
What I would say there, though, and this is like one of the dangers, he's this national media figure, or kind of was, you know, he's not as much anymore, but coming down to Oxford, Mississippi, talking to a fairly conservative white audience. There might be some Democrats, but you get my point.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all laughing about it. They kind of say it in joking ways. even some of what John Meacham said, I went, you know, I kind of expect better than that out of a historian. And they're talking to this audience, and that's, and he's being flippant about it by then. And it, and he had already had all this criticism about how NBC gave the open mic to Trump, and, you know, that, that crazy Lauer, whatever that was, wasn't the debate, but the way he questioned Clinton and all those other things that Lack was part of. And so I wrote about all of that in the Dame piece, because it's just, but here's the thing. And this is what I wrote about in there. It's systemic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like if you went back and saw, you know, I put some historic stuff in there, about how he had kind of gotten called out in the media back in 20 years ago or something about how he was talking about women. They didn't have executive, women executive producers because they didn't want to work that hard and that kind of language. And so you get those, and it, you know, it's ultimately what Ronan Farrow was doing too, was showing the systemic problems, you know, and how mm-hmm. it's handed down. And so that's what my piece in Dame was about. But you said it earlier, we don't think enough about systemic sexism.
Yeah.
You know, we don't think enough about systemic racism, but at least we're starting to have that conversation. But we have to be willing to go backward and look at, so when we talk about systemic reporting, that's what we're talking about, is going back into the past and looking at the trends, or looking at the steps forward and how this led to this led to this.
Right.
And so, you know, and at some point, if people understand that well enough, they know that it's not just a bad apple they're dealing with. They're dealing with a whole bunch of bad apples hiring other bad apples, and making it okay to do these things because that's part of the culture, whether it's the actual assault or harassment, or whether it's just this kind, these attitudes, these sexist, misogynist attitudes that very often, you know, some of the stuff I deal with, I mean, I've dealt with it all on some level, from attempts to sleep with me on a job interview where I flew across the country to,
yuck.
To, yeah, it was awful, to people getting mad at me now because I do some sort of media critique out loud, and then men calling other male advisory board members to tell on me. Or at the Jackson Free Press, where I, you know, my partner was Todd, my life partner too, you know, we were co-founders, he's a publisher, I'm the editor. Men would write him and tell him to make me stop. And he would say, I can't do that. You know, you, why don't you get in touch with her? But my point in saying that is that that's what it still is happening.
Yeah.
Is that it's this behind, it's this belittling, kind of like Lack was doing, of Hillary Clinton being unlikable across the country, regardless of how many votes she got. And it, and it's this, you know, belittling of women, you know, and making it equal to, and I've dealt with this for 20 years at least in Mississippi, personal, horrible personal attacks coming from men because I say something that is about critique of media or something serious, right? And then people and across the political spectrum will say, oh, well, you're having a Twitter beef with so-and-so, or you're in a battle. There's a war between this person and this person. And I'm like, how are these two things equal?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just being an intelligent woman over here most of the time. I'm not saying I don't get pissy here and there, but, you know, with especially pissy back to this, but it's like, I'm saying something that I believe is important to the future of my state.
Yeah.
And these people are going after the size of my butt or something. And here I am. It's seriously, that's happened. Here I am in a Twitter beef, or I'm in a war because of the way they are responding to me in a misogynistic way. And we saw that just play out on a national stage with Hillary Clinton, you know, just in every possible way, and media putting unconfirmed, you know, stuff from WikiLeaks and all these other things out there, just slamming them out there. And it just, I don't know, none of that was, it may be national media, but none of that was journalism that I would want any of my folks to emulate.
Yeah, no, it's gross. All yeah. of that, you know, in a word,
I love that.
It makes me shudder, really.
I know it makes me shudder too, but you know, you just have to keep going through it, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. You say Twitter beef, you know, that's also, it goes back to what you're saying before about the horse race and the mm-hmm. suggestion that that's a very manly posturing and a way to frame it, you know, like, well, you know, who's going to, who's ahead today and who's this and they're in a beef and you know, it's ultimately not about anything to even say that. Not only is it, I don't know, it dumbs down everything.
Yes.
And makes the discourse into this, you know, you're flinging poo at each other or something, which is not what you're trying to do. It's only what one side is trying to do. So
that's exactly it. It's like, if you're going to, this is my thing. If I'm going to criticize particularly media, and I do that because I believe we should, you know, and I believe we should, because who else is going to do it? We have to hold media to a higher standard, including ourselves. Right. And so if I'm saying those things and then you throw poo at me, these are not equal things.
No, they're not.
You know, but that's still this whole false equivalency frame
that they teach, I guess, at Columbia Journalism School, apparently, from that professor.
Well, they certainly did when I was there, you know, and they probably teach it. Well, I know some of them do at the University of Mississippi. You know, we've gone through some things with them due to some of our reporting, but, I mean, it's not good. But what I always tell people is that, look, I've had everything thrown at me. And I love the new ones who show up and they think that they're going to throw a little thing on Twitter. And then all of a sudden I'm going to go running for the hills. And it's just like, people, you know, I've dealt with this for 20 years in the state of Mississippi and I've had everything comes at me. And so maybe you don't know that, especially now that we're doing a statewide publication instead of, the capital city publication.
Right.
So I have to kind of teach a whole new crop of people that I'm not just going to tuck tail and run.
Yeah. I think you put the emphasis in the wrong place. In that sentence, you said, I've had, you know, lots of people throw things at me in the state of Mississippi. It should be, I've had lots of things thrown at me in the state of Mississippi. Like, yeah. If you can handle that, man, you can handle, you know, you can handle some dumbass on Twitter from the Jersey suburbs or whatever.
I often say look, I'm a woman newspaper editor who tells the truth in the state of Mississippi. Just, you know, I've heard it all, you know? So.
I have one more thing I want to ask you. And then I want you to talk about the Free Press, the project that you're doing.
Oh, okay.
And then talk about, you know, where we can find you and how, you know, if people want to donate or that kind of thing. And that's, I've written about Tate Reeves before. This guy, I don't understand him. And again, I don't want it to be political because I don't think I think it's just as possible for a Democrat to be loopy with the vaccines and stuff. But I don't understand how a guy can come in on this huge pro-life sort of platform. At least that's how it reads from where I sit. He likes to equate himself with quote unquote pro-life. He turns down the Medicare, the Medicaid money from the government. The rank in all of these things is super low. The COVID rank, the COVID numbers are terrible. And I think you had a thing on the Free Press today that the death rate is the highest that passed New Jersey this week in Mississippi. And Reeves is a guy who was right after Abbott at the same time that said, no, we're not going to have masks. We're going to open up. We're going to do all these things. Even though if you look at his Instagram page, his daughter is, his little girls are there wearing masks and they have signs up on their door in cute handwriting saying must have mask to enter and stuff like that. I don't know what my question is, but do people really take this, like, how can people take this guy seriously when he's clearly a hypocrite? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out. I'm not even trying to be funny.
Well, you know, what I would say to that is, well, one thing I think we should clarify, at least he didn't make it illegal for any school districts to do mask mandates. That's the best thing I can say. Even though he, from the very beginning, even last year has, you know, we put a lot of pressure on and some other media to have some statewide mandates last year. It took a lot. And so I wanted to just make that clear that he's not exactly the same as Abbott, even though I think he's competing for that. What I would say is that, you know, it's almost, to me, it's almost not about Reeves. It's about how somebody like that kind of routinely on some level or another becomes our leaders. I mean, it's just in some ways it's, he's no Trump in the sense, I mean, I think he wants to be, but
yeah,
but it's the same way that a Trump becomes, becomes a leader, right? The real answer is in history. It's in, you know, what the Republican Party, and I don't say this partisan wise, this history, what the Republican Party decided to become by and after the Civil Rights Movement, which was to go after white, conservative, racist voters.
Yeah.
Now they don't, none of them think they're racist, but you know, the things they, they're fine being in a party with, you know, 99.9% whatever, you know, white people. So it's about, you know, it's about primary races. I mean, Reeves is worried, is wants to win the primary, and the primary, you know, so that he doesn't, because his biggest threat would probably be another Republican, because he's kind of like Phil Bryant before him. I've heard very few people, Republican or Democratic, say they like him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about being liked. It's about playing to a fairly small number of people who vote and who want to push an ideology. You know, it's the kind, I'm going to be writing more about this soon, but it's the ideology that the Citizens Council really embraced, not just the overtly racist part, but the using the small government, the government's coming after you, socialism, communism. They're using all of those things and they're going to take over and control you. I had a very intelligent conversation for a Guardian piece with a woman who used to be the head of the Republican Party here, who is still a Republican, but not a Tate Reeves Republican.
Okay.
Who said that people are so brainwashed into believing that communism is going to take over that they will believe. And I think that's nationally, people don't take this quite seriously enough, that these memes are there. They yeah. are. So the freedom meme that the government is not going to, we're not going to let the government force vaccines on you. We're going to sue them. Not even seeing the irony in any of this, that one government suing the other. Anyway, but we're going to try to stop them from doing that. The point is not stopping them from doing that. He's been vaccinated. His whole family's been vaccinated. His daughters, at least one of them, had COVID. It's not about that. It's about getting to those voters who stay with them out of fear of something that many of them don't quite understand. And yeah. it's this. So, but the big thing I want to say there is that this kind of media paradigm that we talk about, that we've talked about here, plays into that.
Absolutely.
Because it's this or that. In our last governor's election, we had three Republicans running. One of them was a Republican who was the more moderate Republican, son of a former Republican governor, who had more gravitas than Reeves would ever think about having, clearly more, at least outwardly intelligent, all these other things, supported Medicaid reform, as he called it, which would be an expansion. So did the crazy right-wing one, Robert Foster, who's, you know, and, but the media never, they never framed it in such a way where they focused on the issues. I say the media, other than us. I mean, and yeah. I, at the time I just had Jackson Free Press. They never covered that right. In fact, the day after a Republican debate where it was, those three men, I think, were in the Republic, but I know the two main ones that I'm talking about. One of the statewide headlines was that the debate was all about who was more conservative. And that was the frame, was who was more conservative. So this is what I'm interested in these times, because we're going to keep getting ridiculous people elected in the state of Mississippi, whatever party they are, until we figure out some of these things. And right. And I'm in the media, so that's what I believe in working with, because that's what I know something about. We can't just follow these strategists around, you know, and Democrats here, you know, they run to be who's to get part of that crazy little white conservative group, you know, so there are no options.
Right.
And so either people leave or they don't vote, or the ones who do vote are frustrated because, and then there are just no options. I mean, I liked Bill Waller, the moderate Republican. I thought he would be at least as good a governor as Jim Hood, who was the Democrat. And I can't tell you, because of Jim Hood's record on criminal justice and death penalty, I mean, keeping a woman in prison that our reporting finally got out, supported the death penalty. I can't tell you who I'd have voted for.
Yeah.
In the general election. I mean, I suspect, and I've been known to vote occasionally for a Republican in the state, who, and that's saying something in the state, but you know,
right, sure.
You know, and so I might have voted for Bill Waller. And so just the fact that he never had a chance because of the way the media frames it, and because of the way and that allows the Republican Party in the state to just, people should know better, to just go off a deep end in the way that they run these campaigns. And then the horse race, you know, of it is what's covered. I mean, right. In a way, that's exactly what happened with Trump.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
With misogyny thrown in to help. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if he'd have succeeded if she'd have been a man, probably wouldn't have. But yeah, so that's what I would say. I mean, I could go on and on about the crazy.
No, that's interesting. And that moves around from place to place. But it does give us a place to land, because we are running out of time. And I want to mm-hmm. get to talk a little bit about this project that you're doing going into the systemic reporting in Mississippi, and then you know, let people know how they can support the Mississippi Free Press. Because I think, you know, like
I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the work you're doing is really valuable, I think, I think I've made clear. Yeah.
Well, so what we had to figure out, and we have these really cool maps that you've seen, but what we had to figure out is if we were going to be a statewide nonprofit, which was a dream of mine for a long time. And by the way, we have the very same name as a wonderful civil rights era newspaper that was done by a multiracial group, and Medgar Evers was one of them. And his daughter's on our advisory board.
Oh, wow.
Gave her blessing before I used the name. If we were going to cover the whole state, that's hard. We have 82 counties. We don't have the resources to be in every city council meeting and every, you know, county supervisors meeting, all of that. And so one, as I was thinking over the years about how, if we ever got to fulfill my dream of having a statewide publication, how we would do that. And it was really this training and things that I told you about, particularly in systemic racism, structural racism, systemic thinking, that kind of got me to this point. So we call it systemic reporting. And what we mean by that, ultimately, I'm also a solutions journalism fan, but I don't think that the most effective solutions journalism is going and spending your time finding solutions that might work for what I like to think of as symptoms. And so what I mean by that is I think we have to dig all the way into the roots in public education, in criminal justice systems, or violence reduction, education, healthcare, to kind of understand why the inequities are there. Because I'm enough of a Mississippian and have dealt with enough of them over the years to know that if people don't have the knowledge about how, you know, like a project we're working on now, Noxubee County, how the Klan and other white supremacist groups that most people don't even know existed here because they don't know their own history, shut down all Black schools in that area. because the Klan focused on black schools was one of their things. So that black people, and I bet you a lot of people don't know that, so that black people didn't get any kind of education, just like they focused on the political system in Reconstruction. So they would shut down. They focused on doctors who were supporting elections. So what I'm saying is that the history piece of it is to show people through the years what the attempts have been to keep black children from getting a good education, like in Knoxby County. That's one that we're about to start publishing. So we're doing, we have a, like on this one project, we have a team of black women journalists who are looking at why COVID-19 hit black women and their families in the early months harder than any other group, including black men, which wasn't all the case in all states. In that particular thing. And so we're looking at that. We're zooming in on education. We're zooming in on healthcare. We're zooming in on public safety, actually, which I think will surprise people, but I think it'll make sense when they see it. And then we're picking counties in different parts of the state. And so we're to zoom in. So then we do that reporting. We show people what the causes and the symptoms of those inequities are, how it was passed down, what the effects are today, with data and storytelling, and then ultimately the solutions journalism piece comes in. So in Knoxby County, one of them is, okay, what are the solutions to the broad, to the lack of broadband that basically shut down education in Knoxby County when COVID hit? What's the solution to the mental health and trauma problems that, you know, that, so my point is there's nothing really partisan about any of that, because no. Nobody has done a good job with this, ultimately. I'm not saying certain people haven't tried. So through that, we're telling those stories. And so we have, at this point, you've seen it, we have 14 focus projects that we hope to do in the next 2 years that are going in deep into one area or another. Like one is a public education solutions lab, but it's to do this. We're picking counties to show their resegregation, to show all these other things, the economic impact on the, you know, on this crumbling state of, I just see it, you know, segregation around the state has just broken the state. And when I drive around the state, I see it. And so that's systemic. It has history pieces, it has data pieces, it has comparisons, but then ultimately by focusing on at least three counties in each project, more as we can, ultimately, we are comparing and contrasting, and then those counties, the state tends to be very sectional, those counties can see what other counties are doing. And then it starts, hopefully, because we also call it networking Mississippi, in addition to mapping Mississippi, hopefully it means that people are drawing more connections and efficacy through learning what people in other parts of the state are doing. And then we also use these solution circles, which have been virtual for now, but these dialogues where we do this deep listening of what people are telling us they need, which isn't always what we think, and then what they think the potential solutions ought to be. And so that's a summary, but it's all about the systems. You know, I believe in systems analysis. This affected this, this affected this, this caused this. And I think most reporting doesn't look at things systemically. I think we're seeing more that does now. And I'm thrilled about it. I've been doing some presentations and consulting with some people in other states about how to do this, but everybody needs to do that. It's like, that's what I meant about, you know, that doesn't just need to be your black reporters. And in the case of race violence, which is one of my specialties, it's like that you, I'm not going to ask a black reporter to do reporting on just traumatic, brutal race violence that happened in these counties unless they want to do it.
Yeah.
Because I think that's, you know, in white people's burden in some ways to face white terrorism and to make sure that people understand how that worked and the effects, not just that. You may have seen me say this. I hate the crazy clucker in the corner syndrome. I came up with that phrase some years ago, you know, and But people across the country do it in some way or another. Oh, that was just Mississippi. Them. Oh, it was so racist down there. Or that was in Mississippi. Oh, that's that crazy redneck that lived over in that part of town. And what ends up being true is that the whole, all of the systems in the state of Mississippi, to the Daily Newspaper Company that owned the Clarion Ledger and the Jackson Daily News, work together in racist systems. And that's also true in the country, maybe not quite as pronounced as it was in Mississippi. So that's the stuff that we're trying to educate people about. And so we believe that when, and I've seen it happen, but we think this new effort that's really, and we're getting different pieces of it funded. So that's one thing I wanted to mention, the funding. You know, we've got, people love the mapping. We show them the maps.
Very cool.
So we say, you know, if you want to give us operations funds so we can spend it where we think we need it, we prefer that. But if you also want to help fund the education project, or if you want to help fund that, like I've got one organization who's I can't say what yet, but is funding a healthcare reporter to work on a piece of it that starts basically at the beginning of the year for a year. That's exciting, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how we're trying to do it.
So how can people, where can people go online to learn more about this? What's the.
Well, what I would say, well, go to the website, MississippiFreePress.org, which is also mfp.ms. There's a link at the top of our site for donating. Our fundraising from an individual level is really great because from across the country, people really are liking what we're doing. And so, and then of course, the more small donors we get, the more large donors we can get. So that's very helpful to us. And our donation link is mfp.ms/donate. I encourage people to do that. I think there will be there'll be a map there where you can kind of see how to see everything that we're doing here. We also do a show called MFP Live. That's pretty cool. Y'all can see more about that in a podcast. So you can see all of that on the front page as well.
Well, this is all fantastic. This has been such a great discussion. I wasn't sure where we were going to go, but we covered all my bases that I want to cover and much more. Totally, totally fascinating. So Donna Ladd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signadella, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.